One of our members sent me an interesting article this week from The Guardian. The headline states, two-thirds of U.S. believers see COVID-19 as a message from God. The story goes on to describe the findings from a poll put out by the Chicago Divinity School, where people who claim a belief in God overwhelmingly say that God is using the current crisis to tell humanity to change how it lives. And the article gives quotes like this one from Lance DeJesus of Dallastown, Pennsylvania, who says, "I don't know, it just seems like everything was going on in an okay direction, and all of a sudden you get this coronavirus thing that happens, pops out of nowhere. It could be a sign, like, hey, get your act together." Now combine the virus with murder hornets invading North America and the largest outbreak of locusts in decades in Eastern Africa, and this certainly seems like a time with plague and pestilence of biblical proportions. But of course, this is no Charlton Heston movie. This is real life. As we all know, COVID-19 is causing remarkable human suffering. Over 5 million people infected and over 330,000 people dead. Economies decimated. Millions of people out of work. Healthcare stretched to the limit. Education systems reeling. Parents at their wits' end. Mental health and addiction and domestic issues festering away behind closed doors. This is a time of remarkable human suffering, and so it is not at all surprising that people are asking, as in that Guardian story, how is God at work in all of this? So this morning, over these next minutes, we will explore this question. We will develop a theology of the pandemic. Now, the most classic definition of theology is from Anselm of Canterbury, who said in the 11th century that theology is faith seeking understanding, not achieving understanding, but seeking understanding. In our seeking, you and I may get to different places, and that is okay. After the service, we will open up a Zoom meeting to check in and discuss anything that is on our minds. But first, let us turn to the experience of another community of faith seeking understanding in their time. The scholarly consensus is that the epistle known as 1 Peter was not written by Simon Peter, the de facto leader of the 12, but by a disciple of Peter's sometime after the apostle's death. The letter was written to a Gentile audience in northern Asia Minor who had converted to Christianity. The passage that Karen just read for us describes a fiery ordeal that is gripping the community and likens the suffering they are experiencing to the sufferings of Christ. And like Jesus, the sufferings these early Christians are experiencing are a result of a conflict with the Roman Empire. You see, in those days, the Roman Emperor was to be worshipped as if a god. This is the apotheosis, the elevation of Caesar to the divine realm. Domitian, who was the emperor during this time, took the title of Lord and God and ordered his subjects to publicly confess that he was this Lord and God as a test of their loyalty. Christian adherence to monotheism, the worship of the God of Israel, put followers of Jesus into a treasonous position of not participating in this imperial cult. It also meant that they did not participate in the idol worship and ostentatious worship feasts and festivals of the empire. The Christians of this time were known as the people of the way because their experience of the ways of Jesus led them to an entirely different way of life from the rest of society. Through their communal mindset and that put limits on personal freedoms for the good of the whole, they were labeled as subversive in a culture that prioritized power and status and the cult of personality. By their declaration that Jesus was Lord, not Caesar, they were deemed disloyal and dangerous. Make no mistake, to be Christian was not just a spiritual but also a political decision. Remember that there was no such thing as cultural Christianity in this time. None of those earlier followers were born Christian. They made the conscious choice. They used their free will to change the way they were living and to follow Christ. And because their way of life was threatening to the status quo, Christians were ostracized and persecuted. In some places in the empire, they were subject to violence or even put to death. It was into this environment that the letter of 1 Peter was written. to a people of faith who were suffering because they looked at the culture around them and said, no, no, there is a better way. The letter of 1 Peter was written to strengthen the spirits of these people and to help give them hope and encouragement and to offer some practical advice on how to deal with this time of disruption. Humble yourself, the writer says. Do not fall into the traps of hubris or arrogance. Humble yourself and set all of your anxiety on God, because God cares for you. Discipline yourself, the writer says. Discipline yourself and do not waver from what you know to be true. Be alert. Be alert, for the forces of this world are powerful and cunning. Resist. Resist evil in all its forms. Stand beside your sisters and brothers from all over the world who are experiencing the same suffering and resist evil. And then finally, the writer of 1 Peter says that they are sharing in the sufferings of Christ. But take heart. Whatever suffering you have felt, Christ has felt first. Whatever oppression and violence you experience, Christ has experienced it as well. Whatever cross you bear, Christ bore it too. In his book, Saved from Sacrifice, the theologian Mark Haim makes the argument that the suffering of Jesus on the cross had the result of putting on display the very worst of humanity, the sacrificial scapegoating, the propensity for violence, the mob mentality. The worst of us was laid bare so that all could see what we as a species are capable of. All could see with clear eyes and then pledge to live in a different way. And in many ways, I believe the same is happening with the coronavirus. The virus has laid bare what people who have been oppressed or marginalized have known all along, the injustice and unsustainability of the world we have created. Every human on the planet is equally susceptible to this virus. And yet, because of the systems we have put in place, it is the most vulnerable who are placed at greatest risk. Those in overcrowded refugee camps, those in underfunded long-term care facilities, those in unsafe shelter systems, those with low-paying jobs forced to make the impossible choice between safety or rent. The virus has laid bare where we have set our priorities. As the debate on reopening has become politicized, we are putting on full display what idols we worship at. Is it any wonder that so many are wondering if the virus is a message from God? In the psalm that Jeff read for us earlier, we hear of a God of great power. It speaks of the earth quaking and the heavens pouring down with rain at the presence of God. Scripture speaks decisively of the power and sovereignty of the Creator God. And yet it also speaks of the unique gift of the Creator to humanity, the gift of free will. Despite God's power, God does not override or supersede this remarkable gift. God sets the parameters for living. The laws of life fall both in the laws of nature and the laws of Torah. But we decide if we will follow them or not. When we fail, God works through the prophets, both old and new, both Isaiah and Greta. God works through the prophets to warn of the consequences of not living in right relationship. But we get to decide to heed the prophet's call or not. Now, when we wonder about God's role in our current crisis, our theology of the pandemic, we should tread humbly and remember the story of Job. And when he questioned God, God spoke of a divine perspective and knowledge beyond human understanding. But if we believe that the overarching characteristic of God is love, then we can say with conviction that just as God did not cause the crucifixion to happen, God is not causing the coronavirus to engulf the globe like wildfire. God's unique burden is the knowledge that these terrible things can happen, and to honor our free will nonetheless. Like any parent knows, when your child suffers, you suffer infinitely more than if it were happening to you. In today's psalm speaks of a God of power, but also a God of love. And God's love for us is so great that God's suffering is beyond all human perspective and understanding. Just as the wounds in Jesus' flesh were felt by the one he called Father, the physical, emotional, and spiritual suffering we are facing now is felt by our divine parent. The great German theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer once said, "It is only a suffering God who can help." Our faith affirms that God's love is steadfast and tenacious and relentless. God will not quit until God's good intentions for creation have been fulfilled. On this last Sunday of the Easter season, we remember how God reacted and responded to suffering through the resurrection of Jesus. In the crucifixion, the very worst of us was laid bare, the sacrificial scapegoating, the propensity for violence, the mob mentality. But God said no. No. There is a better way. New life is possible. A renewed world is within reach. Without overriding or superseding free will, God invites humanity back into right relationship. God ignites a great turning that changes the world. And this, I believe, is the moment we are in again now. I believe God is at work in this moment of disruption and suffering, when our eyes have been opened to the failure of our ways, to invite us into something new. This is a moment beyond our perspective and understanding. This is a moment that requires faith, and it requires imagination. But take heart. Just a few short months ago, could we have imagined the canals of Venice running clear? Or that there would be genuine talk of a guaranteed basic income? Or renewed visions of economies based on energy, not just on oil? Could we have imagined the public waking to the realization of how dependent we are on long undervalued frontline workers who are predominantly women and people of color? Or that it is impossible to shelter in place if you don't have a home? Or that viruses don't care how famous you are or how much money you have? And while we are not there yet, can we now imagine the whole world coming to the understanding that we really are in this together? God's love is steadfast and tenacious and relentless. God will not quit until God's good intentions for creation have been fulfilled. And with the gift of our free will, we have the opportunity to participate in these good intentions. As Christians, we should hear afresh the call in 1 Peter, the call to humility, to realize that we will only ever have a partial perspective on the whole, the call to personal discipline, and a commitment to live in right relationship with others and with nature, the call to attentiveness of the systems of injustice and domination that we unconsciously take part in every day, and the call to resist. The call to resist evil in all its forms, to stand beside our siblings from all over the world who are experiencing the same suffering, and to resist evil when we stand in solidarity with each other, especially the ones the world abuses. We stand in solidarity with Christ. This solidarity may take us to the front lines. It may take us to the realms of public policy or business or politics or law. It may take us to the places of healing and care and comfort. Wherever there is suffering, there we are called, because there we will encounter Christ. What if God is using this moment to invite us into something new? On this last Sunday of Easter, we are called to imagine that we are on the precipice of a great turning that will change the world. And this is good news. My heart shall sing of the day you bring. Let the fires of your justice burn. Wipe away all tears, for the dawn draws near and the world is about to turn.
cries out with a joyful shout that the God of my heart is great. And my spirit sings of the wondrous things that you bring to the ones who wait. You fixed your sight on your servant's plight, and my weakness you did not spurn. So from east to west shall my name be blessed, could the world be about to turn. My heart shall sing of the day you bring, let the fires of your justice burn. Wipe away all tears, for the dawn draws near, and the world is about to turn. Though I am small, my God, my all, you work great things in me. Mercy will last from the depths of the past to the end of the age to be. Your very name puts the proud to shame, and to those who would for you yearn. You'll show your might, put the strong to flight, for the world is about to turn. My heart shall sing of the day you bring, let the fires of your justice burn. All tears, for the dawn draws near, and the world is about to turn. From the halls of power to the fortress tower, not a stone will be left on stone. Let the king beware, for your justice tears every tyrant from his throne. The hungry poor shall weep no more for the food they can never earn. There are tables spread, every mouth be fed, for the world is about to turn. My heart shall sing of the day you bring, let the fires of your justice burn. Wipe away all tears, for the dawn draws near, and the world is about to turn. Mercy must deliver us from the conqueror's crushing grasp. The saving word that our forebears heard is the promise which holds us bound. Till the spear and rod can be crushed by God, who is turning the world around. My heart shall sing of the day you bring, let the fires of your justice burn. Away all tears, for the dawn draws near, and the world is about to turn. My heart shall sing of the day you bring, let the fires of your justice burn. Wipe away all tears, for the dawn draws near, and the world is about to turn.